shared my concern that we'd taken our eye off the ball with respect to bin Laden. His immediate response was, quote, "None of what you are saying is true," unquote. We then had a 40-minute wide-range conversation, which left me second-guessing some of my long-standing criticism. He seemed earnest and honest. I left wondering if perhaps he was the best dance partner we could find in that part of the world. For the next few years, Musharraf went into a self-imposed exile in Dubai and London, but he continued to return to the Philadelphia main line to stay with Raza and Sabina, who took to referring to their back patio as the Musharraf deck. When a Musharraf visit in 2010, during which he was in exile, coincided with our U.S. midterm elections, my wife suggested I take him with me when I voted. He's the second most important person to ride in my car. One morning I drove Philly skipper Charlie Manuel down the Schuylkill to Citizens Bank Park. At my quaint polling place in Lower Merion Township, we walked past yard signs for Pat Toomey, Joe Sestak, Tom Corbett, and Dan Honorato, as I told him of American voter apathy and bragged that I had never missed an election. I will not forget his reply, quote, "You said you've always voted? Let me shock you by saying that I have never voted, except in the last 8 years while president," unquote. The people manning my polling place could not have been more gracious. They allowed me to enter my polling booth accompanied by President Musharraf, and I took delight in showing him our means of casting a ballot. When we exited, Musharraf told me that because of the number of illiterate Pakistanis, they recorded ballots for symbols, not parties or individuals. He also shared that he would compete in Pakistan's 2013 election. He'd already settled on his party's symbol, a Shaheen falcon. Quote, "It flies higher than all other birds," he told me. "It doesn't fly in a flock. It is independent. It flies alone. It doesn't come back to a nest. So I think it's a symbol which shows independence, which shows courage, which shows confidence," unquote. Musharraf did return to Pakistan in 2013 after 4 years in exile, but was disqualified from taking part in the election. Jack Kemp's winning game plan. Philadelphia Daily News, May 7, 2009. I had my last conversation with Jack Kemp in October. No surprise, our focus was to be on tax policy, but the part of our dialogue that will always stay with me had to do with football and his family. I asked him if he could still throw a spiral at 73. Quote, "I can throw a spiral," he assured me. "I can't throw it very far anymore. I used to be able to throw it, believe it or not, about 90 yards. But you know, I've aged a little bit. I was in Vail, Colorado last summer with my grandsons, and they put the ball on the ground, ran out for a pass and said, 'Grandpa, Grandpa, throw me a pass.' By the time I picked up the ball, they were 50 yards down the field, and I said, 'Hey, come back to around 15, unquote. Kemp was the Republican quarterback who tried to rewrite the party's playbook. Others will remember Kemp as a professional football player, 9-term congressman, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development for Bush 41, and VP candidate for Bob Dole. I'll remember him as a one-time boss. In 1991, HUD was divided into 10 regions, and I was a federal housing commissioner responsible for the one that included Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, and Washington, D.C. This was at a time when HUD, under Kemp's leadership, was trying to transfer ownership of public housing to the tenants. One of the first was to be Tyler House, a Washington development. That's where I met Elaine Johns. Ms. Johns, then approaching 70, was a tenant leader who had invited Kemp for a tour of Tyler House in June of 1989. Kemp was so disgusted by the conditions. Quote, "The rats are so bad here, you find them in the hall. You get up in the morning and you find them dead in your apartment," unquote, Johns said at the time, that he described them as, quote unquote, scandalous. He vowed to make it a poster child for his homeownership initiative. Before my meeting with Ms. Johns, roughly 2 years later, I remember being told by a colleague that I needed to be particularly attentive to her. When I asked why, I was told that whenever Ms. Johns called Kemp, he took the call. That was classic Kemp. He wasn't politicking for the sake of appearing populist. He was accessible because people like Elaine Johns were at the heart of the two most important causes in his political career: incentive-oriented economics and equality-oriented politics. Kemp was a believer in giving people, especially minorities, a bigger stake in their own future. That's why he pushed his initiative to sell public housing tenants their apartments, quote, with the fervor of a Southern Baptist preacher, unquote, as a New York Times reporter wrote in 1996. It's also why he became a lone GOP voice urging the party to apply the principles of fiscal conservatism to address urban problems and reach out to minority constituents. Kemp, a self-described, quote-unquote, bleeding-heart conservative, working in an administration perceived as inattentive to urban issues, received three standing ovations during a speech at the NAACP's annual convention in 1989. Quote, "You see, real leadership is not just seeing the realities of what we are temporarily faced with, but seeing the possibilities and potential that can be realized by lifting up people's vision of what they can be," unquote, he wrote in a letter to his 17 grandchildren published a few weeks after our October conversation. Unfortunately, too many of those now playing the games that Kemp did, athletics and politics, are in it for the stats or the soundbite. They'd be better off running the routes recommended by Kemp, the GOP quarterback, so invested in his playbook that a consultant once told him, quote, "If I could remove two-thirds of your knowledge and three-fourths of your vocabulary, I could make you into a decent candidate," unquote. I first met Congressman Jack Kemp when I was an undergraduate at Lehigh University and dropped into his Capitol Hill office with a paperback copy of his book, An American Renaissance, A Strategy for the 1980s, tucked under my arm. His gatekeeper and longtime office manager, Sharon Zalaska, let me in to see him. I was excited to meet him and eager for him to sign the book, so much so that I became flustered when he asked me where I was studying. I said Lehigh, and when he asked me to spell it, I got tongue-tied, and I said L-E-H-I-G-H, but it was too late. The resulting inscription reads, quote, "Best wishes to you and L-E-I-H-I-G-H, YRs, from a fellow soldier and friend, Jack Kemp," unquote. A decade later, he called to invite me to serve as one of his 10 regional administrators in the Department of Housing and Urban Development, clearly having forgotten that not so long before, I had trouble spelling the name of my own school. Checking in with Smokin' Joe to thank him for his dignity. Philadelphia Inquirer, May 17, 2009. Hard to believe. It's already been a month since the great Harry Callis passed away. The Phillies, from the memorial cigarette to the black HK uniform patches to that famous home run call now playing after each hometown dinger, offered him an honorable tribute. So too did the fans, thousands of whom visited Citizens Bank Park to pay their respects. Only Jack Buck and Babe Ruth got similar send-offs. Harry the K got his just due in death. But as usual, it came a little late. Too often the accolades flow when the recipient is no longer around to hear them. We've all lost people close to us and regretted never having told them what they meant to us in life. It's true for both non-celebrities and celebrities. Take Joe Frazier. HBO's Thrilla in Manila depicts the bitter feud behind the three epic fights between Frazier and Muhammad Ali. That era and those bouts have been well documented, but Thrilla is different. It shows us what the battle looked like from Smokin' Joe's corner. Like the fact that the two rivals had once been friends, or that Frazier gave Ali money when the latter's boxing license was revoked in the late 1960s, and that Smokin' Joe lobbied President Richard Nixon in support of Ali's reinstatement. Ali's return to the ring, however, brought a change of attitude. He mocked Frazier in public. He called him stupid and ugly. He race-baited for the cameras, calling Frazier an Uncle Tom and a tool of his white backers. Quote, "He's the other type of Negro," unquote, Ali asserted. He riffed about Frazier as a gorilla and sparred with a man in a gorilla suit, all as the cameras rolled. In other words, he took the pre-fight shtick way too far. And while Ali would later apologize to Frazier's son, Marvis, he's never offered a personal apology to Frazier himself. Too bad it's taken more than 30 years to get a glimpse of that era through Frazier's battered eyes. Ali has long been feted as one of the greatest sportsmen who ever lived.
Smokin' Joe, meanwhile, lives in a room above his gym in a North Philadelphia neighborhood labeled the Badlands.
As Ali biographer Thomas Hauser notes in the film, quote, "It's an interesting look at how America treats its sporting icons. Some are accorded special status, and others are largely forgotten," unquote. I hope Joe Frazier, now 65, doesn't feel forgotten. Where possible, the icons among us should be told today just how we feel about them. It shouldn't take Tim Russert's passing to spark a conversation about civility in today's media world, or Jack Kemp's death to inspire the GOP to make an honest effort in his name at reaching out to minorities and urban communities. And it's not limited to the rich and famous. Each of us has family and friends to whom we owe gratitude, or perhaps people with whom we need to reconcile. It shouldn't take a memorial service or a funeral for us to think about doing so. A few weeks ago, I called Smokin' Joe Frazier to tell him what he meant to my youth and how he'd helped cultivate my appreciation of the sweet science. I thought he should understand that there are millions of people who acknowledge his commitment to the sport and the dignity with which he's always carried himself. Unfortunately, what Thrilla made clear is the reality that Frazier's sense of dignity and sportsmanship has gone unheralded since he left the ring. He told me he's concerned with influencing, quote, the young one, who's growing up to be a young man or young woman as time goes by. We're going to have to represent them right so that they can carry on the right way. If we're not right, how are we going to make our kids right, unquote. I then asked the former Olympic and heavyweight champ if he's happy, and the response was vintage Joe Frazier. Quote, "The Lord's been good to me," unquote, he said, before telling a story about a car accident that caused him significant pain and resulted in multiple surgeries on his neck. Quote, "From that day on, I've been walking with a little hippie hop, but I get around the best I can, so it's no problem," unquote, he said. "I was glad I made the call." Joe Frazier passed on November 7, 2011 after a battle with liver cancer. He was just 67 years old. While saddened over his death, I was pleased that I had picked up the telephone 2 years prior to tell him what he meant to me. For 2 days, a Friday and Saturday, Frazier lay in state at the Wells Fargo Center, home of the Philadelphia Flyers and 76ers. Like thousands of others, I drove to the South Philadelphia Sports Palace to pay my respects. Smokin' Joe was laid out at what would be center ice in a closed white casket. A black cowboy hat, which he fancied wearing later in life, was sitting on top of the casket, and nearby was one of the fight posters from his legendary March 8, 1971 fight against Muhammad Ali at Madison Square Garden, often referred to as the fight of the century. Ali was among the 4,000 mourners on the following Monday who attended Frazier's funeral service at the Anand Tabernacle Baptist Church in Philadelphia. If you've not yet seen it, I highly recommend an HBO Sports documentary about that initial Frazier versus Ali fight called Ali Frazier 1, One Nation Divisible. It tells the story of the remarkable fight between two undefeated heavyweights in largely political terms that helped me appreciate why, when I was just 9 years old, our white suburban Philadelphia family was in Frazier's corner, not Ali's. 1-800-POLITICAL-VENOM. Philadelphia Daily News, September 3rd, 2009. I'm on vacation this week. It couldn't have come soon enough. This is the first time off I've had in 8 months, and 2009 has been an incredibly exhausting and newsy year. I was looking forward to some neglected leisure activities and projects around the house. I promised our sons that we'd go kayaking on the Delaware and told my wife that I'd finally clean up a makeshift pet memorial in the backyard. The to-do list also included trying to get new home phone service straightened out with Verizon. On Tuesday, I called Verizon and was connected to Annie, not her real name. She asked what number I was calling about, and I offered one of several that might get her to my account. She told me that line had been disconnected, even though I just used it, and that it had last been called by Obama for America, cavalierly sharing her access to far too much information. Too bad she didn't let it go at that. Quote, "He's not for America," unquote, she volunteered. "Excuse me," I said. She repeated herself and then casually told me that the president, quote, "is a communist, a Marxist-Leninist," unquote. Of course, I'm no stranger to discussing politics by phone. I make a living fielding calls and debating the issues with my listeners. But I didn't field this call. I made it. And having initiated it, I couldn't exercise the radio host's prerogative and hang up on myself. Even worse, I didn't make the call to talk politics. I just wanted to get my phone fixed. I'd done nothing to invite Annie's diatribe, yet she was insistent that I listen to her robotic regurgitation of the talking points she'd likely absorbed hours earlier. I told her I found her comments inappropriate, if not outright offensive, but she didn't let up. She proceeded to tell me that the president's parents and individuals in his administration were also communists. So convinced of the righteousness of her beliefs, Annie was ready to espouse them to anybody who called. It was as if she fancied herself a talk show host ready to do battle with her callers, even though her audience was simply those people whose phone lines needed Verizon's attention. This is the sorry state of political discourse in America today. Annie was so certain of the opinions that someone else had told her that she was ready to regurgitate them to any hapless caller, the brazen audacity that transformed so many town hall meetings into shouting matches. I told Annie she should save her views for after hours and concentrate on my phone. When she persisted, I told her I wanted her last name and the names of her supervisors. She initially demurred on supplying her own name, but readily offered two names, one male, one female. When I asked to be connected to the woman, she said she was off. When I requested the man, our connection ended. By then, the kids were dressed for the kayaks, and the last thing I wanted to do was get into a squabble about politics while on vacation, much less wait on hold to recount what had just happened. But there was no way I was letting this pass. So I called the same 800 number and tracked down her male supervisor. He heard me out but seemed more intent on telling me to calm down than getting my name or phone number. I demanded he take both. He promised to look into the situation. That day on the Delaware, I told my sons what had happened. I explained that I complained to Verizon just as I would have if the operator had volunteered that George W. Bush lied about Iraq or offered some equally reprehensible view from another political extreme. And I explained that I viewed this as more than just an aberrant woman in a company call center. As we paddled and I recalled our conversation, what stood out was not only the outlandish charges against the president, but the ease with which she recited them, to a stranger, and while on someone else's dime. It was as if the mention of the president's name, which she herself brought up after accessing my billing records, had pushed a button that caused her to spin out of control. And the manner in which she stated her views told me she was someone who viewed her own disparagement of our nation's leader as some kind of badge of patriotism. Well, Annie, you're no Tom Paine, nor is there a war being fought for independence. And if the venom being spewed against the president isn't reined in soon, I fear your mindset will give aid and encouragement to some sicko who thinks it's his place to protect the republic through the barrel of a gun. Just before the business day ended, my cell phone rang. It was some big mahaf in Verizon's Pittsburgh call center. He wanted to apologize on behalf of the company. I told him I appreciated the call and had no ill will toward Verizon, and that I hoped the call had been recorded, quote, for training purposes, unquote, and would indeed be used for that. I suspect that when Annie is confronted with my complaint, she won't hedge, but will readily admit her behavior because she believes she is fighting for some principle higher than her job. I conveyed my suspicions to the Mahaff. His chuckle told me I was correct. We are truly in a sorry state. Can you hear me now, Annie? On a subsequent occasion after my phone call with Annie, I had a problem with my telephone service. When I called and wasn't getting satisfactory service, the Verizon representative at the other end of the line said, "What are you going to do? Get me fired too?" It became obvious that word had spread within Verizon that I'd written this column. So I'm sure they heard me. Sorry, but for me, the party is over. Philadelphia Inquirer, February 21, 2010. It took only the single tap of a computer key, and just like that, I'd exited the Republican Party after 30 years of active membership. The context might sound impulsive, but I'd been thinking of becoming an independent for a long time. I just hadn't expected that a trip to renew my driver's license would mark the end. Just before my photo was snapped, I was asked if I wanted to register to vote. For me, the question was borderline offensive. I first registered after turning 18 in the spring of 1980 and haven't missed an election since. And I'm not just talking presidential races, I mean all elections. Congress, town council, school board, whatever. Quote, "I'm already registered," unquote, I offered. Next came the unexpected question of whether I wished to change my political affiliation. I'm not sure why that is asked of someone renewing a driver's license, and I question whether it is even appropriate for most. But in my case, it was the only impetus I needed. Years ago, I grew tired of having my television or radio introduction accompanied by a label with some implied expectation that what would then come from my mouth were the party talking points. That was me 26 years ago when I was the youngest elected member of the state delegation to the Republican National Convention, but not today. I'm not sure if I left the Republican Party or the party left me. All I know is that I no longer feel comfortable. The national GOP is a party of exclusion and litmus tests, dominated on social issues by the religious right, with zero discernible outreach by the national party to anyone who doesn't fit neatly within its parameters. Instead, the GOP has extended itself to its fringe, while throwing under the bus long-standing members like New York Assemblywoman Didi Scozza-Fava, a McCain-Palin supporter in 2008, who told me she voted with her Republican leadership 90% of the time before running for Congress last fall. Which is not to say I feel comfortable in the Democratic Party either. Weeks before Indiana Democratic Senator Evan Bayh's announcement that he will not seek re-election, I noted the centrist former governor's words to the Wall Street Journal's Gerald Seib. "Too many Democrats," Bayh said in that interview, "are quote-unquote tone-deaf to Americans' belief that the party had, quote, overreached rather than looking for consensus with moderates and independents," unquote. Where political parties once existed to create coalitions and win elections, now they seek to advance strict ideological agendas. In today's terms, it's hard to imagine the GOP tent once housing such disparate figures as conservative Barry Goldwater and liberal New Yorker Jacob Javits, while John Stennis of Mississippi and Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts coexisted as Democratic contemporaries. Collegiality is non-existent today, and any outreach across an aisle is castigated as weakness by the talking heads who constantly stir a pot of discontent. So vicious is the political climate that within 2 years, Senator John McCain has gone from GOP standard bearer to its endangered species list, all of which leaves homeless those of us with views that don't stack up neatly in any ideological box the way we're told they should. Consider that I've long insisted on the need to profile in the war against terrorists. I believe that if someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has actionable intelligence on future terrorism, you try the least coercive methods to extract it, but ultimately stop at damn near nothing to get what you need to save American lives. I want the U.S. military out of Iraq, but into Pakistan. I'm for capital punishment. I think our porous borders need to be secured before we determine how to deal with the millions of illegal immigrants already within them. Sounds pretty conservative. But wait. I think that in 2008, the GOP was wrong to adopt a party platform that maintained a strict opposition to abortion without at least carving out exceptions in the case of rape, incest, or danger to the mother's life. I was appalled that legislators tried to decide Terry Schiavo's end-of-life plan. I don't care if two guys hook up any more than they should care about my heterosexual lifestyle, and I still don't know what to think about climate change. I think President Obama is earnest, smart, and much more a centrist than his Tea Party caricature suggests. He has never been given a fair chance to succeed by those who openly crow about their desire to see him fail while somehow congratulating one another on their relative patriotism. I know he was born in America, isn't a socialist, and doesn't worship in a mosque. I get that he inherited a minefield. Still, the level of federal spending concerns me. And he never closed the deal with me that health insurance is a right, not a privilege. But I'm not folding the tent on him. Not now, not with the nation fighting two wars while its economy still teeters on the brink of collapse. All of which leaves me in a partisan no man's land, albeit surrounded by many others, especially my neighbors. By quitting the GOP, I have actually joined the largest group of American voters. According to the latest Washington Post ABC News poll, 39% of Americans identify themselves as independents, compared with 32% who said they are Democrats and 26% who are self-described members of the GOP. Nowhere is this more pronounced than locally, where a shift away from the Republican Party has taken place in the four bellwether counties surrounding Philadelphia. I will miss casting a ballot in the spring, as current state election law prohibits unaffiliated voters from voting in GOP or Democratic primary elections. Instead, I'll join the others who bide their time until fall, when we can temper the extremes of both parties. Quote, my decision should not be interpreted for more than it is, a very difficult, deeply personal one. I value my independence. I am not motivated by strident partisanship or ideology, unquote. Those are Bi's words, not mine, but he was speaking for both of us. As I wrote in the column, my exit from the GOP was a long time coming, and I'm now much more comfortable being registered in Pennsylvania as a quote-unquote non-affiliated, the Commonwealth lingo for independent. I did rejoin the GOP briefly in 2016 because I couldn't stand the thought of having no say in the presidential primary. I cast a ballot for John Kasich and then promptly left the party again. Of course, my transition begs the question, did I leave the GOP? Or did the GOP leave me? Well, probably a little bit of each. There's no doubt my views have moderated as I've gotten older on a number of important issues, including abortion, climate change, same-sex marriage, and gun control. But both parties have become increasingly inhospitable to ideological non-purists, which is an enormous change since I came of age politically. Don't take my word for it. Consider that for nearly three decades, the National Journal took the ideological pulse of the Congress, and in 2014-2015, for the fourth straight year, the Journal found that every Republican in the Senate was more conservative than every Democrat, and every Democrat was more liberal than every Republican. The House was similarly divided. But that isn't the way it's always been. As recently as the 1980s, on Ronald Reagan's watch, the Senate was comprised 60% of moderates. In fact, there were so many moderates on the Republican side of the aisle that they had their own weekly gathering called the Wednesday Lunch Club. Members included Bob Dole, Alan Simpson, Bob Packwood, Ted Stevens, Nancy Kassebaum, John Hines, and my friend Arlen Specter. Today, there are no moderates left in the Senate. For this, I primarily blame the polarization of the media. There's no coincidence in the fact that since the early 1990s, the media has moved in a polarized direction, and so too has Washington, and it's clearly a matter of causation. Too many elected officials take their cues from men and women with microphones who wield outsized influence
in the primary process. There are other drivers of the polarized divide, namely money, social media, geography, and self-sorting, each of which has contributed to the skewing of our debate. But more than any other cause, I fault the desire of those who stir the pot for ratings and mouse clicks without regard for governance, which requires cooperation and compromise. And here's confirmation of what I see. The National Journal, which used to publish that annual assessment of Congress, stopped publishing its weekly magazine in 2015 after 46 years in print, which editor Ron Brownstein, under the headline Facts, RIP, partly attributed to the partisan climate. Quote, but mostly, Brownstein wrote, I think the magazine's position deteriorated because the market for its core product eroded as our political system has grown more rigidly partisan. Fewer elected officials now follow the sequence of gathering objective information and then reaching a decision. Usually they follow ideological or partisan signals to reach decisions and then seek talking points to support them. With that change, Washington reporting has evolved further towards sports reporting that partisans consult mainly to see whether their side is winning each day's competition. National Journal could never entirely compete in that world, unquote. Yard Sale 101, Philadelphia Daily News, May 13, 2010. While federal regulators spent last weekend unsuccessfully hunting for the cause of last Thursday's momentary financial meltdown, I was monitoring a classic American enterprise. It featured a partnership agreement, product development, and market research, not to mention an advertising plan, pricing strategy, concessions, negotiations, and money handling. Unlike the current financial markets and their fluctuations, this one didn't require a PhD in economics to follow. It was a yard sale run largely by our three sons, ages 9, 12, and 14. Weeks ago, I'd proposed that they manage the sale with a twofold purpose. First, to relieve our garage and attic of all the stuff we'd accumulated but didn't need or want. And second, to use it as a device to teach them some of the rudiments of economics. Now that it's over, I think Wall Street can learn more from the boys than they can learn from Wall Street. The lesson would be about returning to basics. First, the boys had to work out their partnership. Would they split the profits equally, or was the eldest entitled to a larger share of the take? Would Dad get reimbursed for using his truck to haul the goods? Second, they needed product. Good thing their Uncle Pat, better known as Captain Pat, was willing to rid his garage of some items, including a vintage Coca-Cola sign. They had flower pots, books, CDs, toys, a go-kart, two bikes, and an old-fashioned radio. Their market research consisted of visiting a few sales on the weekends before their own. At one, the homemade brownies seemed to do brisk business. Suddenly, food became a consideration. Marketing consisted of two newspaper ads and some road signage for the morning of the event. As for the negotiating strategy, I recommended they cut whatever deals were necessary in order to spare us a trip to Goodwill. My wife and I promised to stay off the floor as best we could, leaving the boys to run their own show. That meant they'd handle all the money. Immediately, the ethics of business confronted them. While they were setting up the night before, a man arrived, newspaper ad in hand, saying his son was graduating from high school the next day. He was hoping to get a look at the Coca-Cola sign. Was it proper to sell before the sale started? The boys didn't hesitate. The sign went for full price. The buyer offered a $5 tip for allowing him to make the purchase, which only reinforced the boys' belief that they'd sold it too cheap. I wonder if he uses the line about his son's graduation the night before all sales, our eldest said. The boy's grandmother had been generous in emptying her own cupboard. A blender I recognized from my childhood had an asking price of $5. I heard a man offer $2. One son countered at $3, but another shouted out $2.50, exposing frailties within the partnership. The asking price on the go-kart was $50. There was an offer of 40 and a counter of 45, which closed the deal. Dollar books were popular, so were CDs, flower pots, and framed wall hangings, but not the lamps or the jackets. Ditto for the old radio. Electronics, the phone, TV, and printer were slow movers as well. Interestingly, everyone asked for jewelry. The boys had none in stock. And while the brownie idea had given way to hot coffee and cold water, neither moved on such a mild day. The gross was $713 split three ways, but they seemed to learn several business lessons aside from calculating their take. Beside the product procurement, marketing, and pricing, they also learned about shifts. One brother could take a break only if the two others were on the job. They also paid attention to their client base. I let political correctness be damned as they observed that the nerdy Asian guy bought the video games, the gay guys acquired the empty Tiffany boxes, and the Hispanic family purchased some used clothes. What's clear to me now is that garage sales are a slice of entrepreneurial Americana, unspoiled by the masters of the universe on Wall Street. In fact, here's hoping those operating the world's financial capital take a lesson from the kids. Namely, that they made money selling tangible items, bikes, flower pots, lacrosse sticks, and wrapping paper. Their products could be understood and purchasers knew exactly what they were getting, whether it was a used copy of Walter Isaacson's American Sketches or a slightly scratched Andres Vollenweider CD. For one morning at least, they were engaged in real work, facilitating a real exchange of goods. I'm reminded of the words of Jack Bogle, founder of the Vanguard Group, the largest mutual fund manager in the world. In his book, Enough, which is about to be re-released because of its timeless message, he lamented that this country produces fewer tangible products and depends more on pushing paper than ever. Quote, "Over the past two centuries, our nation has moved from being an agricultural economy to a manufacturing economy to a service economy and now to a predominantly financial economy. But our financial economy, by definition, subtracts from the value created by our productive businesses." Bogle, a true captain of industry who seeks real measures of value and simplicity in financial markets and in life, probably loves a good yard sale. The boys' yard sales were a summer ritual for a few years running. And while the annual event has ended, my sons still swap stories about lessons learned and some of the personalities who were repeat customers. Their goal was to make money. My wife and I were simply eager to have them get rid of stuff we'd accumulated that no longer had value to us. This cycle led to a new family vernacular, yard sale material, appropriately used when one member of my family sees another making an imprudent, impulsive purchase. I'd like to think the regular use of that admonition has curbed our profligacy. That and the fact that each sale was inevitably followed by the embarrassing placement of whatever didn't sell on our curb alongside a spray-painted sign on plywood that simply said, "Free." We'd debate how many days had to tick off the clock between the sale and the gratuitous offering, and wonder about those who had attended the former and were disturbed by the latter. The Power of Pin Money, Philadelphia Daily News, September 9, 2010. How could anybody hate Steven Singer, given the generosity he's exhibited toward the construction of the Flight 93 National Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania? Over the last year, the man whose unique marketing campaign is ubiquitous on Philadelphia radio and billboards has become a fundraising superstar for this worthy national project. His role began last September when I published Instinct, The Man Who Stopped the 20th Hijacker. The book tells the story of Jose Melendez Perez, the immigration inspector who on August 4, 2001, refused to allow Mohammed Al-Qahtani, the intended fifth hijacker on Flight 93, into the United States. Neither Melendez Perez nor I earned a penny from the sale of the book. All author proceeds were donated to the Flight 93 National Memorial. Singer, the prominent jeweler here in Philly, and a sponsor of my radio program, told me he was inspired to do something. Quote, "Since September 11, 2001, I, like most Americans, felt helpless and very much wanted to help make a difference in some small way," unquote, he said. So he designed the 9/11 Never Forget lapel pin, pictured here, and began to sell them to my radio audience for $10.
he donated every cent to the Flight 93 Memorial, covering the production costs and the manpower needed to sell and distribute them, even the shipping fees. Last year, our effort raised more than $30,000. 3 weeks ago, he told me he had a goal for this year. I did too. Mine was $50,000. Singer scoffed and said his was $100,000. Well, 2 days to go before the 9th anniversary of 9/11, I'm thrilled to say that he was right and I was wrong. We just surpassed $100,000 with orders shipping to all 50 states. The response has been staggering. Quote, I love the pin. Being a firefighter who was on standby for the 9/11 tragedy, it holds a place in my heart that I will never forget that day and everything about it, and am a full supporter of the Flight 93 Memorial, unquote, one individual wrote to Singer. Quote, as a survivor from the 105th floor of 2 World Trade Center, I must tell you that your pins are an incredibly fitting tribute to those lost that day and an outstanding way to help us all never forget. I now have a small but significant tattoo on my right wrist, the hand I cross my heart with, that is a replica of the pin. It is my way of marking my experience and always remembering, unquote, wrote another. Alice Hoagland, the mother of Flight 93 hero Mark Bingham, called the effort, quote unquote, thrilling and quote unquote, absolutely special, which is the highest praise. Hoagland is a woman of remarkable strength, and her son was a shining example of the rugged individualism that defined Flight 93 and its legacy. Bingham was a 6'5" rugby player who was gay. He and his fellow passengers stopped Flight 93 just 20 minutes shy of a strike on Washington, D.C. In the weeks and months after that day, a makeshift memorial overlooking the crash site was created as thousands of people streamed to Shanksville to pay their respects. They have never stopped. According to Jeff Reinbold, the Memorial Project's site manager, almost 1.5 million people have visited the temporary memorial since 9/11. And although construction of the permanent memorial is now underway, the first phase will be completed by next year's 10th anniversary, the fundraising efforts for a second phase are continuing, Reinbold told me. Plans for that expansion include a visitor center and 40 groves of trees representing Flight 93's 40 heroes. Those purchasing Singer's pins will be directly contributing to the completion of this phase by the planner's goal of 2014. That will mean a permanent record of the bravery displayed by the people like Hilda Marson, another passenger on Flight 93. For more than a year, Marson had been planning to move to California to live with her daughter, Carol O'Hare, and Carol's husband, Tom. They were to begin that new chapter of their lives on September 11, 2001. Quote, these people were not soldiers, yet they fought a war at 35,000 feet. That has to mean something, unquote, Carol told me when I asked what the National Memorial will mean to her. Quote, I think history many years from now will treat it as a defining event in our nation's history. But for now, for the families, the purpose of the memorial is to remember, reflect, and honor people they loved in a very personal way, realizing it's much bigger than all of us, unquote. To purchase your pin and make your $10 donation to the Flight 93 National Memorial, visit IHateStevenSinger.com or call 1-800-350-1104. You can also visit Steven Singer Jewelers at the other corner of 8th and Walnut in Center City and buy them in person. Steven Singer is not only a longtime radio advertiser of mine, but also a friend. Over the many years he has sponsored my program, I've come to admire his work ethic, mastery of advertising, and, as this column details, his generosity. I'll get back to the latter attribute later. First, let me tell you that Steven started in the business while he was still in high school at age 17, when his job was selling jewelry wholesale on Philadelphia's Jewelers Row. Steven then completed courses at the Gemological Institute of America, making him an expert in the disciplines of diamond residency, color stones, gem identification, and cultured pearls. In 1980, he opened the doors to his first eponymous jewelry store. By his early 20s, he had already distinguished himself in the nation's oldest and second largest jewelry district, despite having the smallest store on the block. He outgrew that space and several that followed, and that was before he realized his brand's great potential through radio advertising. As Stephen explained in a profile in the Wall Street Journal in the late 1980s, he noticed the buzz that Howard Stern was getting on radio. As per the journal, Stephen, quote, mortgaged his house and opened more than 20 new credit card accounts. The ads cost about $1,000 a minute, he says. Some weeks, he could afford only two or three spots. His wife and his accountant thought he was nuts. Mr. Singer says, but both went along grudgingly. I made it my business to get in good with that show, he says, unquote. The rest was history. I know firsthand his brilliance from my perspective as a broadcaster. So many times over the course of my radio career, I've been requested by advertisers through radio salespeople to make sure that in the span of a fleeting 60 seconds, I say certain words and phrases before repeated references to the telephone number and the quote-unquote ask. If the spot ran 57 seconds, some advertisers would want a 3-second credit. And if all the parameters in the written copy were not met, they would likewise complain even if their ad were afforded an effective read. Then there were those who would use the guise of really wanting your personality on this one, only to then script so much of the 60 seconds that there was no place left to leave my thumbprint. Enter Stephen Singer, the guy who built a jewelry empire with the worse than self-deprecating line, I hate Stephen Singer. Stephen was unlike any advertiser I'd ever met. Just say my name, he told me early in our relationship. Huh? I replied. Do whatever you want to do for 60 seconds. Just say my name. That was his only request. Like I said, a genius. By giving me the freedom and flexibility to say what I wanted to say, he was guaranteeing that his ads would be different, that I wouldn't sleep through a one-minute read, and that by giving me the flexibility to do less, he was actually ensuring he would get more. I'm not saying I've hit a home run with every one of his spots, but on the whole, I think I've given him more than his money's worth. More importantly, I know Stephen to be a very generous guy, as illustrated in this column. As of this writing, Stephen Singer has contributed $449,475 to 9/11 charities over the span of just 7 years. For the first 3 years, his donations went toward the Flight 93 National Memorial in Shanksville, and for the last three, the Garden of Reflection in Bucks County. How could anyone hate a guy like that? Farewell, my daily news friends. Philadelphia Daily News, February 3rd, 2011. This begins with an editor's note. Michael Smirkanish made history here at 400 North Broad Street when 6 years after starting a column for the Daily News, he also began a weekly column in the Inquirer. To our knowledge, no one has ever contributed to both papers in quite the same way. In this and so many ways, Smirkanish is one of a kind. But starting next week, having taken on more work for the Inquirer, he'll be found exclusively in that paper. While this is his last column for the Daily News, we will always consider him a People Paper person. Very nice. More than 9 years ago, at the invitation of then-editor Zach Stahlberg, I penned my first column for the Daily News. And today is my last, since I'll be increasing my work at the Inquirer. I was proud of my first column byline on November 13, 2001, when I made the case for Rudy Giuliani to run the Department of Homeland Security and have remained pleased with my association here ever since. I've written hundreds of columns since then. Many stand the test of time, others don't. I've taken positions on countless controversies, but not all of my views still hold. For profiling against Mumia, for Katz against Street, for Ted Nugent against Pete Rose. I recently perused those many columns. Some are forgettable. Others I wish I could dial back. I'm disappointed that I got carried away with a conspiracy theory linking the Oklahoma City bombing to Mideast terrorists. But I'm proud that on January 2nd, 2003, I wrote, I am terribly disappointed in the Bush administration's public case for the war against Iraq. I called the Duke lacrosse case from the start, quote, it's the revenge of the nerds. Most journalists would never be chosen for a pickup game of hoops, let alone a varsity sport, so they take perverse pleasure in bringing down the BMOC, however undeserved. And every once in a while, I asked a provocative question, like, if Alfred Kinsey were correct in saying that 10% of the population is gay, why did so few same-sex partners emerge seeking compensation from the September 11 Victim Compensation Fund? For rebuilding the Twin Towers as they existed, against the zoo balloon flying so close to the Schuylkill, for keeping the Barnes in Marion, against the Cuba embargo. I once wrote that they could fix the sagging ratings of the Miss America pageant if they'd, quote, bring back the busty baton twirler. That was probably my favorite line. Others have not been so pleased with my work. When I was critical of John Street for not firing an aide who reportedly said, quote, all of these teams are Jews, Jew lawyers and Jew architects, and we need to do something about that, unquote, I found myself on the receiving end of a lawsuit by that speaker. It was thrown out. Other attention was more favorable. Remember the kidnapping of Erica Pratt, the plucky little Philadelphia girl who eventually escaped? After I wrote that those close to her were as much to blame as those who kidnapped her, Bernard Goldberg called to say he was using the column in a book, which he did. Arrogance. Four colored Christmas lights against white ones. For legal prostitution against women with tattoos. It's been interesting to reread my old columns. I was reminded that my disgust with the politicization in the country has been building for a while. After the presidential election in 2004, I wrote, in every green room in the country, there was a liberal and conservative at the ready who, even if uncomfortable with those labels, were willing to be accepted as such for the sake of getting their mugs on camera. Televised politics now caters to the ideologues, the doctrinaire types, lost in their screaming is any chance for a reasoned discussion. People at home take their marching orders from them, then parrot what they've heard, and so it goes, unquote. For buying fireworks in Pennsylvania, against banning beer at Wawa. Probably the most popular column I ever wrote came during the Terri Schiavo controversy when I used my column space to publish a sample living will. People still occasionally write and ask for a copy of it. Certainly the most significant item I published was on April 12, 2004, when I examined a question former Navy Secretary and 9/11 Commission member John Layman had asked Condoleezza Rice at a 9/11 hearing. Quote, were you aware that it was the policy to fine airlines if they have more than two young Arab males in secondary questioning? Because that's discriminatory. Little did I know that Layman's single question would spur me to write my first book, Flying Blind. For a Christmas village at City Hall, against a blank check for Pakistan. Of all that I've written in nearly a decade for the Daily News, I'm most proud of something published August 21, 2008 under the headline Requiem for an Era. In it, I tried to capture how the city had changed in the last few decades based on observations I jotted down while standing in a viewing line as it snaked along a South Philly street. I wrote the entire column on my BlackBerry using my thumbs. I never said whose funeral it was because I thought it would distract from my observations, but I was paying my respects to John Dougherty after the passing of his mother, Mary Teresa, so I'm closing that loop now. Speaking of untimely death, I will never forget editor Michael Sheffer for allowing me to use a column to eulogize the passing of my first dog, Winston, evidence of his being both a friend and savvy editor. And I'll always be a proud Daily News alum. Something had to give. With four kids and four dogs at home, I was getting up at 3 a.m. to deliver a three-hour daily morning drive radio program, appearing increasingly on cable television news, writing books, and cranking out two columns per week, one for the Daily News and one for the Sunday Inquirer. Even with the able assistance of my colleague John McDonald, it was just too much, and I knew I had to choose as to which newspaper association I'd continue. The wider circulation and prominence of the Sunday Inquirer was certainly a consideration in my choice, but so too was the fact that I was no longer living in Center City, Philadelphia, but had moved back to the suburbs. I thought I was better suited writing about issues that appealed to my suburban neighbors, hence my decision to discontinue my columns for the Daily News. Still, I remain eternally grateful to Zach Stallberg and the Daily News for giving me a platform at the People Paper. I like how this recap sign-off perfectly encapsulated my good times at the Daily News and have emulated the style since in several end-of-year columns. Investment giant on living well and Madoff. Philadelphia Inquirer, March 4, 2011. Things have a way of coming full circle for Jack Bogle, founder of mutual fund leader The Vanguard Group. At the midpoint of his sophomore year at Princeton, he was struggling in economics with a D-plus average, which placed his scholarship in jeopardy. The basis of his difficulty? The first edition of what would become the seminal college economics text written by Paul Samuelson. Later, in search of a topic for his senior thesis, Bogle recalled that he read, quote, page 116 of the December 1949 issue of Fortune magazine, unquote, a story about mutual funds titled Big Money in Boston. Inspired, Bogle proceeded to write about an industry that he said could be so much better. He argued that sales charges and expense ratios should be reduced and that funds should be run in the most honest, economical, and efficient way possible. Funds should be run for the benefit of shareholders and not managers, he wrote, and they should make no claim for superiority over market indexes. Years later, that same Fortune would proclaim Bogle one of the four investment giants of the 20th century. And Samuelson, author of the legendary economics text, would write the foreword for Bogle's first book, Bogle on Mutual Funds. Samuelson, the first American Nobel laureate in economics, was both a personal and professional proponent of Bogle. In 2005, Samuelson wrote Bogle a note, quote, "Any small influence on you has been more than offset by what Vanguard has done for my six children and 15 grandchildren. May Darwin bless you," unquote. That same year, Samuelson delivered a speech that ranked Bogle's financial invention with, quote, "Wheel, wine, and cheese, the alphabet, and Gutenberg printing, a mutual fund that never made Bogle rich, but elevated the long-term returns of the mutual fund owners, something new under the sun," unquote. On Monday, Bogle regaled a full house at the Bryn Mawr Film Institute with such anecdotes from his past while celebrating the release of his new book, Don't Count on It. At 81, Bogle was as sharp as ever, displaying no evidence of having just been hospitalized for a touch of the flu. In fact, Bogle recently celebrated the 15th anniversary of his heart transplant, yet shows no signs of slowing down or curtailing the message that he has espoused for decades. And why should he? So much of what he has said for years has come true. Bogle's sense of serendipity extends to things he has preached for decades, ethics and giving value to clients. He is the antithesis of Michael Douglas's character Gordon Gekko, who famously said that, quote, "greed is good," unquote, in the movie Wall Street. To the contrary, while extolling the virtues of entrepreneurship, Bogle is quick to point out, quote, "no, greed is not good. Ambition is good," unquote. Bogle laments that college finance courses and business schools often assert that the only incentives that move the world are financial. Quote, "isn't living a worthy life an incentive?" he asked. "Isn't being a good member of the community an incentive?" I read a wonderful quote the other day. It said, "the great thing about money is that it will buy you all you want of anything in the world that is totally unimportant. It cannot buy you what is important," unquote. The day of his Bryn Mawr presentation, New York Magazine released a jailhouse interview with disgraced financier Bernie Madoff. Quote, "everyone was greedy. I just went along. It's not an excuse," unquote, Madoff told writer Steve Fishman, adding that banks and hedge funds' willingness to work with him and collect their fees, despite obvious irregularities with his business, had amounted to quote-unquote complicity. Bogle agreed. Quote, "well, of course there was complicity," Bogle said. "Why was there? I will give you one example.
These fund managers who used Madoff did not do any due diligence at all, and they were paid over 3 to 5 years just for pointing their fingers to invest over there, $600 million. So, of course, they ignored all the warning signs. Some of these guys, I hope, will go to jail, unquote. Sprinkled into Bogle's remarks were a number of thoughts from a business giant looking at a